We have our altar still decorated with the emphasis, extra emphasis on Yogananda because of the January 5th holiday, which is his birthday. And this marks the end of our festival season, which is, those of you who are from India know that concept, the festival season, which lasts through the good weather in the fall and goes on. There's a 10-day festival here, and then there's a couple of days break, and then there's another festival and another festival, and it's a very glorious time to be in India. And we sort of have our festival season, which is basically from Thanksgiving through January 5th, when everything shifts around and there's just one celebration after another. The only difficulty in our doing it is that life doesn't stop. And so all the other things that we have to do have to be done too. Yesterday we had a 6-hour retreat, meditation retreat day. And we need to really express to people, I know we get a good turnout for it, but I know some people stay away thinking, oh, I've had so much, I've been so busy, I need a day off. It's actually rejuvenation day. In some very interesting way, there's this remarkable rhythm to it, that if at the end of all that busyness, one comes back and spends another day in silent meditation, it's as if the whole system just goes right back and it integrates all the inspiration of the holidays and puts it deep inside. And then also somehow all the tiredness is gone, all the sense of busy is gone. We're just there where we need to be again, having taken it all in and become something else. In our reading today, it's very interesting. The first reading of the year is "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was manifest as the Infinite Spirit." Today is the second day. Did God create the universe, or did he become it? And so what we're talking about today, last week we talked about who is the avatar. Today we're talking about who are we? Where did we come from? And it says in the Gospel of John that the light descended, and the light was the life of all, and the darkness comprehended it not. It's such an interesting juxtaposition, that particular phrase, that the darkness is incapable of understanding light by its very nature, because the dark is dark. It is not light. So when you're in the dark, the light is simply and literally incomprehensible to you. There was a book, and the name of it has long since gone out of my mind, unfortunately, but it was an extremely interesting story of a death and return. People call it near-death experiences, but it's sort of like temporary death experiences, because it isn't near, it really happens. People exit their bodies and they're gone, and they go into the universe that you go to after you leave your body. It's just that you come back from it. So it's a death and return experience. Yogananda, in this talk we were listening to yesterday as part of our meditation day, it was how to overcome all sorrow and suffering. And he talked a lot about the fear of death in a certain section of that, about how many times people's sorrow and anxiety is related either to the death of loved ones or to the anticipation of their own death. And he makes these unequivocal statements that he has a right to make because of the expanded state of his consciousness. Most people try to guess about the state of death, but Master says very casually, oh, I die many times. I can leave my body anytime I want. I can live in this world or the other world. And he even makes reference to, on the day of the all-day meditation, he was late, on the 24th, of the all-day meditation, he was late because he was in such a deep state of samadhi that he didn't actually think he was ever coming back. And it was just of no consequence to him whether he lived in his body or not. It doesn't make any difference. So completely different from the way the rest of us relate to it, because we are identified as the self and the body are one reality. So there's this, at least a small amount, no matter what our philosophy might be, of concern that if we lose the body, we'll lose ourselves. And Master was trying to reassure those who mourn for those who die or worry because someone seemed to die a painful death. Master said, when your soul exits from your body, you don't even know that you've left a body behind, is how he put it. Because you are so much yourself still, because the self merely animates the body. It is not defined by the body. And so when the self walks out of the body, it doesn't really know that anything has happened because it's still intact. And the identification with the body is automatically gone. So this picture we have of this great awful event when someone dies is only awful from our point of view. It's not at all awful from their point of view. They just slide over and that's that. And then they're alive again. Swamiji had a dream about someone who had died, and he sort of said to her rather cheerfully, "Well, how do you like being dead?" And she said, "I'm not dead," just like that, like, "Don't insult me, I'm not dead. I'm perfectly present, just the same as I've always been." So we have this reality of the divine spirit. I had a thought that I was going, and I went out, and I want to find it back again, but I don't know actually anywhere where it is. I bookmarked it, but I lost it. It'll pop into my head at some complete point when it's an utter non sequitur, and I'll just bring it back in then, because otherwise I'll get lots of notes from people saying, "You never finished, what did you mean?" Oh, the death and return story, I remember now, about the woman. And she was a very, not a refined person in the way that she lived, although I think she was a nurse, so she wasn't completely self-centered. But she lived culturally in a very modern way. And she tried to kill herself, and she actually tried to kill herself while listening to some very harsh modern music. And I've begun to realize that I've become quite a fanatic on this point. Oh, what a surprise. When I grew up as a child, I had an uncle, and my uncle's still living. He's 97 now. And he was so annoying to our family, and especially to us kids, because he absolutely, this was like in the 50s, he just couldn't stand the Muzak that was played everywhere. So when he would come out, he and his wife would come to visit, we'd have to research every place that we would go, because anywhere we'd go that had unpleasant music, he would make a scene and we wouldn't be able to go there. So all of our favorite restaurants were out and everything like that. And I have observed myself, and we as kids used to just roll our eyes, you know, it was just such a nuisance to have him come. And I'm exactly like that. I mean, but to the letter. "Oh, honey," I say to my husband, "we can't stay here. The music is just too much for me." Well, anyway, this woman was listening to some very dissonant music. And she actually, I think, shot herself while the music was playing. And when she went to the other side, she went to hell. See, most people who have death and return go to heaven. But she went to hell. She actually went to hell. And she found all these people. This is the darkness comprehended it not. This is where this is coming from. She said she saw all these people, and they were all sitting in a very self-contained reality, the kind of reality that would drive you to kill yourself. She didn't know if they were all suicides, but they were all living in a completely small universe. The only reality was what they were subjectively able to experience. If a person takes their own life, they've obviously shrunk down into such a subjective world that there's no future, there's no hope, they can't think about the effect on other people. You can see how it gets small. So she went down into that place because that was where her consciousness was. And she also realized when she was there that the vibration of that place was the music she was listening to when she shot herself. Because it was this self-contained energy of all about myself and my desires and what I want and what people are doing for me and not doing for me and all of this kind of energy. It's not just random, you know, that this music is not a good idea. It's because it really reinforces a vibration that draws us into darkness. Because make no mistake about it, darkness exists. Yes, darkness is only the absence of light. But if you remove yourself far enough from the light source, there won't be any light where you're standing. If the sun is way over there and you cloud it up with all of these shutters, layers of desire not to comprehend it, I don't want to know. I mean, all of you know what it's like when you get captured by a mood, when you get captured by a thought that tells you there is, in fact, you know, my true reality. You know, I thought that there was a reason for happiness, but now I know that that was just a delusion. And once you shutter your mind, no amount of reason, no amount of other people trying to reassure you can ever reach you. And it's very frustrating to work with people who are like that. It takes an extraordinary divine gift to be able to work with people, just patiently, patiently, patiently reaffirming the truth until something breaks through, because the light was there, but the darkness comprehends it not. You know, sometimes people meditate with these little sleep shades on. Sometimes when I travel on the airplane, I put on those little sleep shades, and you forget, you fall asleep, you forget where you are and that you're sleeping. You open your eyes, and just for a moment, it's like, this is really strange, you know? And then you take it off, and you're back. But that's what we do with our minds. We shutter it like that. And so the light's there, but we don't believe it anymore. So this woman goes into this hell, and she sees all these individual people, all of them, you know, garbed in this downward-pulling energy that's persuaded them that there's no hope. And she said it was terrifying to her because some of them looked like they'd been there a really, really long time. She literally referred to the clothes they were wearing as in some cases being ancient styles. And they just seemed to be sitting there like that. And she realized that she'd made a really terrible mistake. And the thought of God in some form crossed her mind. And as soon as that happened, she was inspired to look up, and she saw that there were angels hovering around this dark place trying to reach these people. It was their divine service. Don't think when you go to the astral world you're going on holiday. No chance. You know, not a chance. When my friend Paula died, just before she died, she was talking to Swami on the phone, and she said, I hope they have a job for me in the astral world. She said, you know me, I like to be busy. Swamiji said, I'm sure they do, Paul. They're just waiting for you to come there. Her desire to help people was not going to change merely because she stopped being Paula. Her essential self would still be there. And I have to say, I felt after she died for quite some time afterwards that she was helping me. The way she helped me when she was in her Paula form, she helped me by the fact of her existence and her absolute sweetness often would inspire me in the same direction. And I could feel her after she died. Now be nice, you know, it's kind of whispering in my ear, be nice. My friend Durga, who had to play the harmonium for Maria Warner's funeral recently. And Durga was having a little trouble playing because she was a little overcome by the feeling of Maria having passed away. And she heard in her mind, Maria was an absolutely no-nonsense person. She heard Maria say in her mind, get it together, Durga. You know, like, fine that you have all these feelings, but get it together. You know, this is the time. So we don't change when we die. We're just exactly the same as we are. So here she is, and she sees there are all these angelic beings trying to help these people. The light is present. The darkness is not comprehending it. But she thought of it for a moment, and then she saw the light, and then she came out. And then, in fact, she came back into her body because she realized what a terrible mistake it was and how much she had been influenced by that dark influence. And actually, she made a career out of going around and talking to young people about what choices they were making and what they were bringing into their consciousness or not. It's very interesting. There's so much going on in this world that we really don't know anything about, because it to the extent that we live in darkness, and perhaps we're not living in darkness as profound, thank God, as those poor souls that were trapped in that hell. But see, that wasn't a God-created hell. That was being so caught in darkness that we lost track of the light, that we literally couldn't comprehend it. Now, there's many other esoteric meanings to that passage, but this one is good enough. And it's very helpful to us because the question that's asked here is, did God create the world or did we become it? Did he become it? And it seems like a very esoteric idea that we can sort of spend a lot of time spinning intellectual theories about, but it's really an extremely practical question. And it's a very practical question for us ourselves to really deeply integrate into our understanding on a minute-by-minute basis. Because you see, if God became us, then we are never separated and we never have any reason for unhappiness. We have never had any reason for fear. We are never distant. There is not this great mental effort required sort of to reach to something that we aren't already. so much of our lives we spend reaching for something that we aren't, just trying so hard to be something that we are not. I've become acquainted through a young woman friend recently of just the extent to which women, and I'm just not going to say that women have it particularly harder than men, but just the way women are so inculcated in our society with body image. And just spending all this time trying to make the body different than it is, and not to have it age, and not to have it do all these other things, and my, is that a losing battle. You know, isn't that something? In my own life, I've always been a bit of a bohemian and a little more than a small degree a rebel, walking around as I do now in my Nayaswami little costume that I wear all the time. You know, it's like it doesn't occur to me, or rarely occurs to me, to be concerned about it. When I was about 15, actually, that was when the beatniks started. I was a little young to be a beatnik, but they had my heart, believe me. When I was 15, I realized that fashion is entirely a question of whether or not you're embarrassed. And if you're not embarrassed, there's no such thing. I mean, what is it enforced by? It's enforced by everybody looking at you. And if you just look back. And I've always found it so amusing how even, you know, naturally one is influenced regardless of how independent you are, one is influenced. I'm always amazed by how when the fashion first comes out, I can tell it's ugly. But a year later, I'm holding pieces of it in my hand and thinking, that's cute. You know, and it's just like it just works its way into your brain until it seems normal to you. Swami Kriyananda remarked once that anybody who follows fashion has no taste. Because if you have your own taste, you don't follow fashion. You just wear what you like, think what you like. I remember my aunt, the wife of the same uncle, who's now in the astral world, saying to me at some point sort of comfortingly, oh, you'll figure out. Because I was just frantic about this before I was 15, you know, like, how do I be somebody I'm not? How am I supposed to know who I'm supposed to be? You see how much of this world is always telling us from the outside? It's always telling us from the outside. It's so rare to find an individual who can just draw the energy from inside themselves. But you see, drawing the energy from inside is where the light comes from. It's not that fashion is darkness. I know some of my friends follow it just for the fun of it. You know, it's a petty enthusiasm. You have to do something in this world. You live here. You know, so we have all these petty enthusiasms to just pass the time from birth to death as we kind of go forward, trying to be God realized. It's not meant, at least not the path that we're on. Some rays of the divine are very, very austere, and you really don't get to do anything. We're quite fortunate in Master's path because he pleasantly integrated us into this world. We get to live in pleasant homes. We get to wear cute clothes if we want to. You know, we get to get our hair fixed nice, and men get to go out and play sports, and everybody gets to kind of live more or less normal, but with a comprehension of the divine light dwelling within us. And this is where we come to the Bhagavad Gita passage, which is really quite a remarkable one. I am, the Lord says, I am the sweet smell of the earth. I am the manliness of men. I am the liquidity of water. All of these different things. I'm the luminescence of the sun. I'm the luminescence of the moon. And he goes on from there. In other words, what he's describing, and there's an esoteric side to that passage too, which I'll speak of briefly, but what he's describing is anything that you look at, the essence of it is the light of the infinite within. That's what it is. There is no other animating reality. Speaking of death, which is a very good example of all of these things at all times, you know, people are so serious about death, it's really not necessary at all to be serious about it. It's such an inevitable, natural part of life. And yes, there is that element of loss that we don't get to keep forever, what we thought we were going to keep forever. But hey, we don't, you know? So why not just be perfectly clear about it? This season of the year is the time when our Living Wisdom School does its play. And for the last several years, I've been in the role of helping to put the costumes together for that play. And the first step of that is to go in and with a measuring tape and measure every child. Yeah, there's a general size 4, 5, 6, and 7, but it's good for the kids, and I found it useful to know exactly what size every child is. And my goodness, they're all bigger than they were last year. You know, every single one of them without exception. And some of them have begun to change radically. You know, some that you were looking down at, you've really begun to look up at. And it may sound naive, but I realized absolutely nothing could stop that. I mean, I could want them to stay smaller. I could want them to remain cute like that and not go into that other thing that they all do. You know, which is us. They become us. They're so adorable, and then they become us. You know, you don't really look around at like a 45-year-old man and say, oh, you're so cute. But you look at the little tiny 4-year-old feet, and they're just so darling, you know. But then they're not. But the force of it, you see, that's what was just amazing to me. The force of it, the essence of the power of the divine within them is just pushing them forward. And it's nothing but that. It's not their wish either. One of my friends, when she was trying desperately but completely ineffectually to train her little boy to use the potty instead of the diaper, she tried the mother's best ploy. Don't you want to be a big boy? He said, no. I like being a baby, he said. But so she gave up for a while. And I'm glad to report he's 30 and he did learn. You know, inevitably they always learn. So you can just sort of let it go. You don't have to worry about it because there's that force. Because at the heart, the essence of everything is that moving force. And the children come for a purpose. And the explanation of that line, I am the manliness of men, which you sort of think about virility or sexual prowess or something like that, but Master defines it very differently. The manliness is the inner impulse to become a true man, a true human being, which is to know yourself as the Son of God. And so what Krishna is declaring there is, I am the impelling force, I talked about it last week, that causes the river to seek the sea, that causes the individual soul to seek to be reunited with the light. I am what make us human beings. Yogananda, in the talk we were listening to yesterday, was talking about sorrow and suffering, and he was talking about it's the ego that both has the capacity to release us from sorrow and suffering, and also which causes it in the first place. In this sense, there's a better word in Sanskrit, and the word in Sanskrit is jiva. We try not to impose too many Sanskrit words on people because it just becomes a jumble. But the word jiva is a very good word because jiva is the individualized aspect of the infinite. And the jiva is the part of infinity that becomes identified with the ego. And so when we really want to use an impersonal word, we should call ourselves this jiva in the age of drug-induced spirituality. People were always trying really hard to find other words than I. My favorite was always this unit of consciousness. These people would show up at Ananda sometimes with these sort of not quite grounded spiritual points of view. And there was this woman who always called herself this unit of consciousness. This unit of consciousness is going into town today. Okay. You know? But really, the best word for self is jiva, this jiva. Because that is this aspect of the infinite that has accidentally gotten itself identified in this position. That's where that other phrase, jivan mukta. Mukta means free, liberated. A jivan mukta is one who is freed while still living in the physical body, while still identified, while still acting out this, the jivan mukta. So you can be born not liberated, but become liberated in the course of this body, lose all body identification, but still be here, a jivan mukta. It's a beautiful phrase. But this jiva, let's see now. I have to find the place again. We will. We were talking about the impelling, oh yes, I know, Master was talking about the sorrow and suffering, and he just throws in out of just like nowhere, like he once said to Master once said to Swamiji, if you knew my consciousness like that. Because Master Swamiji was sitting there sort of imagining he could comprehend who Master was. Master said, if you knew my consciousness. And every so often, Yogananda would throw out these phrases in this talk he was saying, which was a sermon he gave at the Hollywood Church about 1951. He said, I've gone lesser other animals, creatures other than man, who don't have such a highly developed sense of self, don't suffer in the same way. And he said, I've gone into the body of a whale, he said. And the whale has no sense of self like a human being has. Human being knows that if this hurts, it's my hand that hurts. And part of the reason you suffer so much is because it's my hand that hurts. But he said, a whale just can sort of abstractly know that there's some suffering happening somewhere. But it doesn't have the developed ego structure. It doesn't have such a deep identity with even with its own body. It animates that body, but it hasn't identified with that body so deeply that every little thing that happens to that body is such a big deal to it. And then he talked about the oversensitivity of human beings and how we're so delicate. You know, this didn't quite go right and I didn't quite have the right sleep last night. And then he goes on, and my back hurts and I have a headache and I have these emotional problems and I was treated this way. And then Master says, that's why I train my people to be tough. And then he said about four times, I want devotees to be tough. But interestingly, he said the word tough like that. I train my devotees to be tough. He repeated it. It was very interesting to hear him say it. But he made it very sweet, like it was a very sweet thing to be tough. In other words, that the jiva separates itself a little bit from everything that it's identified with. Because you can have these difficulties, but you don't always have to identify with them. You can just sort of see them going on off on the side. Swami Kriyananda is a very interesting case that way. Because he's very detached from his own feelings, but that doesn't mean that he's not very sensitive in his feelings. He's very sensitively aware of the nuances of everything and actually feels things more deeply than many, because he often can see the implications, you know, the long-range implications of a certain course of action or something that somebody will do. But he just has that little bit of detachment from it. So you feel it deeply, but you're not so deeply identified with it. And this is the extraordinary paradox of the spiritual life, where the more aware we become, also even the more joyful we become. And see, that's what drives people, as I was talking at the beginning, to try to obliterate their consciousness altogether, is because the more they become aware of things, the more they can't handle all that they're becoming aware of. And you don't know how to balance that reality until it occurs to you that you can step back into where the power of the Spirit is flowing through us. And that animating force, the manliness of men, which is driving us through all these experiences for one purpose only, for us to discover in the center of everything that radiant power of light. Life becomes really so interesting. It's just always endlessly fascinating at that point, because everything is the same puzzle. Everything is this effort of the darkness to obliterate the light and the determination of the jiva to stay in the light. And every challenge to our equanimity, every challenge to our health or well-being, whatever it might be, it's just the same challenge. It's the light was present and the darkness comprehended it not. But when we realize that God became this creation, that there's not one tiny aspect, no matter what it appears to be, that isn't fully an expression of that divine power, you see how very different the whole experience becomes? And how all of your values, all of your intention, everything that you do in life gains this perfect alignment, but one that's quite different than ordinary thinking, but is attuned only with the divine. What joy. And you see, the fun of all of that is, in the end, Satchitananda, ever-existing, ever-conscious, ever-new bliss. That's the end of the story. The darkness can't comprehend it, but the light is always there.